the day, the Saturday night, the election results. Where were you then?
We were in Cabramatta. At I think we were at the Sunnybrook. We were all watching television sets. People, lots of people on phones, as always happens on election night. People talking to scrutineers and. Was there any media around? There probably was. Just the building excitement, I guess, of the result. I don't think the result was clear. I remember McMahon gave his concession speech. Not too late in the evening. It was, I don't know exactly when. Somebody, it'll be there in the record. But it is also interesting that Phil Davis, who was working for, who's a friend of mine, who was working then for, he'd been seconded to Mr. McMahon's staff from Philip Lynch's staff. He tells the story of being in the McMahon home in Bellevue Hill on the Saturday afternoon, surreptitiously trying to draft a concession speech because he had the feeling that, well, he was professional. It could be needed. It may not be needed, but if it was needed, it was better to have one written out than start thinking on your feet. So he was surreptitiously trying to write this. Somebody came into the wherever he was in the house and said, "What are you doing?" He said, "Oh, it's sort of trying to bury everything." He wasn't sort of announcing the fact that he was drafting a concession speech. But in the end, when McMahon did deliver his concession speech that night, it was very dignified. He was he handled it very well. He was generous to the people he should have been generous to. And
had Graham Friedberg drafted any speeches for Whitlam?
I have no idea. I don't.
Acceptance of victory or victory.
Not that I recollect. I would have thought Gough would have had all that in his head. I've still got my shorthand notebooks from around that time, and it's interesting to try and decipher them now, but. I wasn't taking notes between the sort of Friday before the election when I took down a piece to go into The Age on the Friday, and the next entry I've got is the press conference at Mascot on the Sunday, the day after the election. Now, if Graham had dictated something in the way of a speech for Mr. Whitlam on election night, that's about where I would think I should find it. And as I say, I think it was probably all in Mr. Whitlam's head already.
So after the victory is in his hands, then what happened in relation to?
I think we probably had a few drinks, and I think I remember Mungo McCallum, who was a journalist, is still a journalist. Going outside, shaking his fist at the sky and saying, "I told you the sky wouldn't fall in." Yes, lots of celebration. We probably tied a few on, I suspect, until the small hours, and then stayed in Cabramatta. We must have had to scurry around on the Sunday because we got a plane from Sydney back to Canberra on the Sunday. So I imagine as soon as we surfaced, we would have been heading back to our respective Sydney bases and packing up to get back to Canberra.
So we were all meant to travel together?
We did, yes we did. We came back on a RAF aircraft in the afternoon. I remember Kep Enderby was out there at the airport to meet us, and a crowd of several hundred or scores. I don't remember exactly how many people, but it was very exciting.
This was at Mascot, was it?
This is Kep Enderby was there to meet us in Canberra when the plane got to Canberra. But
you mentioned a press conference here at Mascot.
Yeah.
Can you read out some of the material that you recorded on that occasion?
Okay, so this is Mascot, 3rd of December, press conference, 72. "Good afternoon, gentlemen. I think you have already been told that Mr. McMahon has decided to tender his resignation to the Governor-General next Tuesday morning and to advise the Governor-General that he should call me to form the next government. Mr. McMahon also got in touch with Sir John Bunting, the Secretary of the Prime Minister's Department, and then after that Sir John Bunting and I spoke on the telephone, and I'm having talks this afternoon with him and Sir Keith Waller, the Secretary of the Department of Foreign Affairs, Mr. Cooley, Chairman of the Public Service Board, and Mr. Harders, the Secretary of the Attorney General's Department. That is what I'm going down from Mascot for and why we're doing this interview. Oh, sorry, from Mascot where we are doing this interview. Do you have any other plans, Mr. Whitlam was asked. He said, no, they are the only arrangements I have made to meet the four departmental heads that I have mentioned. He went on, you were asking me about how the day before, how the election night was, what we did afterwards. Somebody at the press conference asked, then went on to ask Mr. Whitlam, what have you been doing this morning, sir? He said, what time this morning? I suppose I got to bed about 2 o'clock, and you probably would have as clear an idea of what I was doing in the first 2 hours of the day as I would. And then the post office rang me shortly after 3 to give me the text of a cable from the United States. He's still living in 32 Albert Street, Cabramatta, with a regular phone at this stage. The post office to give me the text of a cable from the United States, observing the description on the cable that it was urgent. I think it could have waited till this morning. Then I suppose I woke up in the natural course about 4:45, and since then, I suppose, giving the minimum to ablutions and associated activities, I've been on the phone or meeting callers or having breakfast. Question, have you spoken to Mr. McMahon? Yes, as I said, Mr. McMahon and I spoke this morning. He rang me this morning while I was having breakfast with our dear neighbours, and he told me of the arrangements which I have already mentioned to you. Question, what was the tone of his conversation? Whitlam, he spoke in the same generous terms as he spoke on television last night.
And
gives a bit of a feeling for how he felt at the time.
Yeah. And then after that, you all flew up to Canberra.
Yes.
And then you were met by Cap Enderby.
Oh, and various others. I'm sure there were other people there. Just I remember Cap because a friend of mine was working for him. Yes, there were lots. There would have been lots of local Canberra people.
Was there another press conference then?
No, I don't think so. I think he went into these meetings with the departmental heads, and that's when they would have, because at this stage he was still, I suppose, thinking about the idea of the duumvirate that he had with Mr. Barnard for the period before seats were settled and caucus could meet and elect a ministry. So he would have been talking about how to proceed, I suppose, in this intervening period.
Did you, during that day, first day or two, did you work exclusively for him? Or did you also continue to work with Graham Frydenberg?
Oh, look, I think it was all so different, Edward, by then. We would have still been operating out of our opposition office, leader of the opposition office. There would have been throngs at the door waiting to get in to see Mr. Whitlam. I don't think anything was normal. We weren't doing anything normal. We did one terrible thing, though, when we packed up and left that office, that Billy Snedden must have taken over the leadership of the Liberal Party after McMahon, because Whitlam had been away on a trip, and he had brought back for Barbara and me a chastity belt, which he got somewhere or other. And we inadvertently left it in the cupboard in the lead of the opposition's office suite when we moved around. It was, I guess, one of those things, if somebody hoped that somebody else would pick it up. Anyway, that was the legacy. Anyway, it was all treated with much merry laughter. Bill,
where did he pick that up?
I don't know. I honestly don't know. It was a gruesome thing. But no, I don't remember.
And what did he say when he presented it?
Oh, well, it was something. There would have been some joke about how, and he thought that, you know, we needed to. He would have made some joke about being careful. He liked to sort of play the father figure a bit, I think.
As you mentioned that, in many respects, you regarded him a bit as a, he was regarded as a father figure.
A bit of, there was a bit of that, yeah. My parents had divorced, and my father was living away from Canberra, and I hadn't seen anything of him for quite, not until December 75 actually. So in this period when I was working for Whitlam, I hadn't any contact with my father. So he was, yes, he filled that space for me a bit.
So Sunday turns over into Monday. Did you Can you recall what you did then?
I think we probably, there was a lot going on. I mean, it's interesting to go back through the shorthand book and see the various issues that were covered. There was a meeting, well, I was taking notes from whoever I was taking notes from, I think a bit everybody, but the South Australian Premier was knocking on his door wanting a change in policy on something or other for South Australia, and the Western Australians were also knocking on the door saying, we need your help to turn over this policy. And so there was a lot of that sort of thing going on, and my notebook sort of full of notes about those sorts of issues.
Did you sit in on any of these meetings? Or
No.
Did he or someone dictate to you afterwards?
One of the blokes would have sat in on the meetings, I'd say, and then come out and dictated something to me.
Can you give an example? Or?
I probably can. Eight. Okay. Oh, well, there's one too. Sir John Bunting confirming the appointments to his staff. Now, I haven't got dates for these, so that's just a letter to Bunting giving the list of people who'd been appointed to his staff. Then there's a note to Sir Frederick Wheeler, who was Secretary of the Treasurer, saying, I understand the PM has discussed with you his conversations with the Premier of South Australia, Mr. Dunstan. Mr. Dunstan spoke to me after speaking to the PM, and these brief notes of our conversation may perhaps assist your officers in preparation of the papers, which I understand the PM has requested, and it goes on through. And then there's something here too about population of the Torres Strait Islands. The Queensland Government, for its own reason, has recently overestimated the population of those Torres Strait Islands likely to be affected by any boundary change, presumably boundary between Australia and Papua New Guinea. And so that addresses that. Then we get in, my notebook gets into all these thank you messages. And I think that probably for the first 2 weeks of government, that's about all I did, was type up these thank you letters. And some of them are, I think, give an indication of Whitlam's respect for the Parliament and his opponents. The first one I've got is to Sir Robert Menzies. Will I read it? Okay. I was profoundly moved by your magnanimous message on my election to this great office. No one is more conscious than I how much the lustre, honour and authority of that office is due to the manner in which you held it with such distinction for so long. No Australian knows better than you the private feelings of one now facing the change from years in opposition to the years of leading an opposition to the burdens and rewards of leading our nation. You would, I think, be surprised to know how much, despite the great differences in our philosophies, I have profited from your example, in particular, your remarkable achievement in rebuilding your party and bringing it so triumphantly to power within 6 years has been a deep inspiration to me. My wife deeply values the message and goodwill from Dame Patty. To both of you, may we express our very sincere wishes for health and richly deserved happiness, not only for the new year, but for many years to come. And there's one there to Tom Hughes, who was the Liberal, he's still a QC. Was he Attorney General? No, I'm not sure. Anyway, dear Tom, I was very touched by your most generous letter. While I am bound to believe that the 28th Parliament will be a great improvement on its predecessor, it will be very much the poorer for your absence. I know that there will be greater opportunities for your qualities to be used in the service of Australia in the years to come. Sending this note against your insistence does not cancel out your claims on that drink. So I guess in a way it just sort of illustrates those friendships between political opponents and the respect he's got for the Parliament. There's another one here to Frank Ford, who was a Labour Prime Minister for, I think, 5 days between Curtin and somebody else.
Chifley.
Dear Frank, I was delighted to have a message from the senior of Australia's two living Labour Prime Ministers. May the duo last long. So the other, well, he's the senior, the other, Gough is the other one, two living Labour Prime Ministers. So that's always, I mean, you've got to sometimes read through these things to get the point. And this one to Doug Anthony. Dear Doug, congratulations on your unopposed re-election as leader of the Australian Country Party. Thank you for your message on my own election. I note that you intend to be deputy leader of the opposition. I can only repeat your own words to me. You really don't know what you're letting yourself in for. I know that in our new roles, the personal warmth between us will continue. Margaret joins me in sending Margot and you the very best wishes for Christmas and the new year.
So these were all, you did a lot during the first week.
They all, it would be a week or 10 days after the election.
So you at this point had been appointed his personal secretary.
Yes, yeah. There's one here from to Lord Casey. Again, I'm sort of just picked these ones out because they're to political opponents, and there's plenty more to political supporters. But this is to Lord Casey. Thank you very much for your message. I have been very moved to find that some of the most generous expressions conveyed to me have come from that distinguished band who led the Liberal Party from opposition to government 23 years ago. My wife joins me in sending you both our sincerest respects and our warmest wishes for your health and happiness for many years ahead. And the last one is to McEwen. And I think McEwen, his parents must have known McEwen just from this, from memory and from this text. Your letter of congratulations gave me the greatest pleasure. As Mary and you know, I inherited a high opinion of you both. In the Parliament, that opinion grew. I have benefited from my contacts and conflicts with you over the years. Margaret and I hope that we shall continue to see both of you from time to time. We wish you health and happiness in this new year. And sorry, one more. Right Honourable John Gorton. Dear John, oh, it's interesting. Right Honourable John Gorton, CHMP, bracket, omit PC. In other words, we didn't refer to the Privy Councillorship because we didn't approve. Dear John, many thanks for your note of congratulations. I shall try to advance some of the causes which you were the first Australian Prime Minister to identify. Margaret joins me in all good wishes to Betty and you. So just that sort of generosity is something that a lot of people don't always see in Wicklam.
This once his prime ministership took off in a work sense. What happened to all of the staff that had been in his office as leader of the opposition?
Well, Peter Cullen moved on. Now, Peter had already moved on in the opposition days. Dick Hall moved on. He stayed for a few months, and then he moved on. Graham became an advisor and moved over to West Block, which he thought was a good idea, but turned out not to be. He found that that was he got sort of isolated from the action. Barbara went to work for Mrs. Whitlam. Lorraine, who had been the receptionist, she went to work in the press office. We had many more people on the staff, so there were some new faces. I, for my sins, went into that little office there outside the PM's office where the personal secretary worked. That's about it, I think. Jim Spiegelman was senior private sec. He stayed on. Peter Walensky came in as the senior private secretary at the PM, and Jim was number two. I think that's about the extent of the opposition staff and where they ended up in government.
So who was appointed his new speechwriter?
It was still Graham. Evan Williams was appointed to the staff, and he wrote quite a lot of the speeches, but Graham was still the principal, or the speechwriter of the principal speeches, I suppose. Press secretary was actually Eric Walsh, and we had a media secretary, David White, so there was, a lot more faces on the office staff. We had private secretaries for all those little offices along that corridor were full with staff.
You described briefly that your new role in our first session. Were there any? So it was to arrange to keep his private correspondence like you were just quoting. Yeah. And in addition to that, you arranged his meetings, appointments?
I looked after his diary, basically, whether who he was... I needed to know, I suppose, who he was going to see. Sometimes I didn't necessarily make the appointment. Somebody else would have arranged it, but they would come to me to fix a time or to tell me so that it went on the daily program, because we had this absolutely essential piece of paper that everybody had to have, which set out the program each morning and all the appointments. So sometimes, yes, I'd have to pass on bad news to people that he didn't want to see, or good news to those he was prepared to see. Invitations. He wasn't always very happy with the questions that I had to ask him, so I did find it hard to get access, because I was asking not very interesting questions a lot of the time. People had more interesting things to ask him, like when do we recognise China and when are we getting out of Vietnam? And I'm saying, does he want to see Joe Blow from Fairfield or something? So there was an element of... the job was less pleasurable than I think I'd enjoyed in opposition. Just was all very different.
Did you deal with the people who wanted to see the Prime Minister in person or over the phone?
Mostly over the phone. Occasionally in person, if it was a member of caucus... I'd have to sort of go knocking on the door and ask if you would see so-and-so, and but mostly it was done on the phone, or by letter, I suppose.
So did you, so they talk about you arranged meetings, but you also made sure that you, presumably part of that would be also making sure that people actually turned up for these meetings?
Didn't really need to do that, you know. It seemed to normally happen that people would arrive. There'd be things though, like if somebody was coming to see him about XYZ, you'd often have to arrange for somebody from the Prime Minister's department to be a note taker, and that was one of the differences, that there was almost always a note taker in a meeting, sometimes a staff member, sometimes a departmental officer, if there was some sort of expertise required, a technical meeting, say. You might have somebody from the department who knew a bit more about the subject. The other thing I guess I was doing was organising travel and passports and all those sorts of things that had to be fixed up.
Did you travel with the PM?
I did for a few trips. I didn't go on all of them, but we went on a few trips in 73. And a few in 74, one or two in 74. So there was he did like to travel overseas.
Can you tell me about those trips? Where were they to? What was your role?
Can we just take a break?
You'd like a little break? Yes. Okay, we'll do that. Right, well, I think we might leave the rest of this talk about the 72 to 75 period until the next session. And particularly the details about travel and other things, to give you a bit more time to think about that. And if we could then move on to the next issue that I want to raise with you, which was the amount of contact you had with parliamentarians over the years, and who in particular that maybe were became special in some way to you.
Well, I suppose in the leader's office, it was inevitable that we had a constant flow of parliamentarians in and out the door. They weren't always there to see Mr. Whitlam. Depending on the hour of the day, sometimes they'd come and... We didn't have room in the opposition office for people to sort of linger whilst sort of business was going, while the House was sitting. The office was a bit too small for that. But certainly in the government days, I used to often have people like Jim Killen would come and sort of sit for half an hour beside my desk and rabbit on about whatever. We used to see a bit of him in the opposition days. He was notorious for playing practical jokes on people, and I do remember in the opposition days he at one stage rang up the Labour whip, Gil Duthie, who was a very neat, tidy little Northern Tasmanian former Methodist minister who was quite a natty dresser, and Killen rang him up one night pretending to be from the London Tailor and Cutter, I think, some sort of a fashion magazine, crinkling paper in the phone as he rabbited on, saying that he'd heard that Mr. Duthie was a smart dresser and he wondered if he could interview him. And then another time the Minister for the Navy was Malcolm Mackay, and for some reason we used to call him his oil. He wasn't a friend of ours, but he was called His Oiliness. And Killen was playing tricks on him by sending wine or grog of some description that he hadn't ordered around to his room, and he'd always come into our office and have a bit of a chuckle about the latest tricks he'd been up to. And he and Whitlam had a very close friendship, especially after politics, but even during politics they used to exchange banter across the chamber and across the room in the office. He was a constant visitor, probably the most constant from the other side. Dudley Irwin was the government whip, and it was his job, I guess, to know what was going on. He used to spend a bit of time. That's where Ainsley Gotto started her parliamentary career, working for Dudley Irwin. He was fun. He used to socialise a bit with us. Francis James was another. Now, he was, for most of the opposition years, he was in China, in prison. But after, in government, he used to come to Canberra. And he had been at school with Gough Whitlam. There's a lot of stories about their time at school together. He'd been a prisoner of war of the Germans in the Second World War. He wore the most grotesque contact lens, which he would take out and clean in front of you if you weren't careful. And they were about a quarter of the size of a boiled egg. It must have been terribly painful. He had very bad eyesight. But he was a lovely chap who was from a very different world from me. He was editor of the Anglican. He used to wear a cape and a hat and swing around the corridors. He gave me a cookbook, which I've still got, which just is inscribed to Miss Summer Hayes from F. James. So there were those sorts of people. There were our own friends, I suppose, from other offices who used to come by for a palate-cleansing ale at the end of a hard day at the office. We all used to go to parties after the house had got up, but we were young, we could do it. Journalists, a lot of journalists didn't come to the office quite so much. I think they realised that there needed to be restrictions on then hanging around an office and listening into what was going on. You couldn't really countenance having the same sort of, well, they wouldn't. They'd drop in for a beer if they were invited, but they probably wouldn't come uninvited. And a lot of my friends, even today, are people, journalists that I met then. We used to go to the movies together on Saturday afternoons and go on picnics and kept in close touch for years and years.